I'm a huge planner. So whenever my wife, Radhi, and I would go on our adventures, I'd meticulously plan out our itineraries and book our accommodations in advance. It's like a yearly tradition that we do. And let me tell you, Booking.com has been my go-to every step of the way. Whether I want to be a simple guy nestled in the countryside or be the stylish and modern guy in the heart of the city, Booking.com never fails to offer a wide range of options that perfectly suit your preferences. And they have everything you need to turn your travel dreams into reality, offering accommodations here in the US. Plus, the ease of booking through the app makes the whole process a breeze. So trust me when I say, when it comes to planning unforgettable getaways, Booking.com is where it's at. Ready to book your next adventure? Book whoever you want to be on Booking.com. Booking.yeah. Herbs have been a huge part of my wellness journey, thanks to my Indian roots. My mom introduced them to me, and I saw firsthand how they worked wonders for both body and mind. And when it comes to keeping my digestion in check, slippery elm bark and ginger root are my go-tos. Our sponsor, Nature's Way, has over 50 years sourcing these herbs and many more that can promote digestive health. Visit naturesway.com/herbs. And use code J10 at checkout for 10% off any herbal supplements through June 30. Terms apply. 90,000 hours. That's approximately how much time an individual will dedicate to work in their lifetime. That's why it's more important than ever to partner with UKG, a company fully dedicated to helping you create a great place to work. With HR, pay, time, and culture solutions, UKG is the only partner that delivers the tools and insights your employees need, no matter who they are, where they work, or what they do. See what UKG can do for your business and your people at ukg.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people.
Every contribution I made to the community was meaningful. So I learned at a very, very young age, you know, when I got into hardcore and punk music, the contributions I made to the community were my cool points. They're the way I got respect.
Hey everyone, welcome back to On Purpose, the number one health and wellness podcast in the world. Thanks to each and every single one of you who turn up every week to listen, to learn, and to grow. Now, I know that my promise to each and every one of you is making sure that I find guests who help us innovate, who help us think differently, who shape culture and redefine the way we live our lives. And today's guest is going to do just that. He's none other than Steve Aoki, the two-time Grammy-nominated producer, DJ, one of today's most successful American cross-genre artists, collectively counting 2.8 listen to this, billion music streams on Spotify. As the founder of the trendsetting record label, Events Lifestyle Company, and apparel line, which he founded in 1996, Steve Aoki has helped launch the careers of global acts like the Chainsmokers, Block Party, the Bloody Beetroots, the Gossip, and the Kills, among many others. Steve, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. Yeah. And I'm excited to talk about your new album and much more, Neon Future 4, available everywhere. But thank you for taking the time to do this, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to sit down with someone who I truly believe has just got this incredible mind where you're able to find juxtapositions and connections and things that most people wouldn't be able to find similarities and synergies, which is what I find so fascinating about you. So I'm really excited that we get to dive into that.
Yeah. I feel like, whenever you're fascinated about like a genre, a topic that you like, someone might not know so much about, but the person in the middle is doing things like, wow, it's like magic. Well, it's like the same thing as when you are doing your own thing, you know, and you know everything around your little corner, and it's the same kind of thing, you know. It's like my whole life is music. As my platform, it's kind of like everything that I like live and die for, my passion, what I bleed for. And so, try a couple of things, one of them hits, you know, then you start finding that success in that pattern. And then things start happening.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Now I know we were just checking in a bit earlier and you were saying you're in your Vegas playhouse. It sounds like the best place to be quarantined in the world.
Yeah.
Tell us about the inspiration behind it and how you've been moving through this time.
Yeah. So I bought my house in 2013. I moved out here from LA. I was living in LA for a good amount of time, over maybe 13, 14 years. And it was very difficult for me to leave Los Angeles because that is where my career really broke. That's where I started to DJ. All my connections in music started to grow. I had so many heartstrings being pulled when I was leaving. But I was barely even there. I was there like towards the end of it. I was there maybe 60 days, 50 days of the year because I was touring so much. So, and then I signed a residency in Las Vegas here. And so I was like, well, it just makes sense to move to Vegas. It's a 45-minute plane ride back to LA where my whole team is. Dimmock is still based out of LA. My management's still based out of LA. I still have a lot of my friends there. And I was like looking for a place in Las Vegas. And I realized, you know, not just is it a great place for me to get away from everything, because that's what sort of happened when I was in LA. I in the beginning, I was like in the thick of it. Like I was at every single party. I was doing every little thing I could just to get my, you know, brand out there and do what I was supposed to do. And then towards the end, I was like, once I built enough of a stable career, I didn't want to be in the thick of it anymore. I just wanted to dip in and dip out whenever I needed to be. So now Vegas is kind of like when I was living in the Hollywood Hills at the end of it. This is like my Las Vegas Hills, you know, because I still go to LA and work, you know, not so much anymore. But so when I moved out here, the residency was great because I was doing, you know, 40 shows a year here. I still am, but not anymore. But and it's a suburban community here. It's strange. It's like people think of Vegas, they think of the Strip, you know, think of craziness, Sin City. It's like it's just pop in 24 hours, you know. But really, it's a sprawling desert, and there's track homes everywhere. There's just small little community outfits all over the place. And this was a perfect place for me to have my mom, you know, and I was crossing my fingers to see if my mom would move in my neighborhood. Cause I never get to see my mom, you know, I'm always traveling and she lives in Newport Beach and I can't always get down there. But she said, okay, you know, she dropped living in Newport Beach for 40 years and moved to Vegas. And one of the best investments I ever made was buying her house. Mm. And then I bought her a nice house. She lives like 15 doors away. Actually, I can see her.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, and then I see, you know, I don't see her as much anymore because we quarantine the hell out of her, make sure she is like bulletproof, you know.
Yeah.
Or microproof, whatever we can do. But so when I got the house here, I didn't realize how big these homes could get. That's the other thing. It's like Los Angeles, there's a limit. You know, if you have like a 4,000 square foot home, that's pretty big in LA. And that's like a multi-million dollar home, depending on where you live. So you could only get so much for the money that you spend. But here, for a couple million dollars, I was able to buy this home, which was 16,000 square feet. Way more square footage than I can even imagine to deal with, you know. But it was a scoop. Like I was like, I have to take this regardless of that it's so big and grow into it or something because of you know, the opportunity that was in front of me. So now I spent like 2 years building it out and developing it, like turning it into what is now called Aoki's Playhouse. And it really is a playhouse. It's like got a foam pit and a trampoline and a gym room. I put a DJ booth in there. So I do my DJ sets. I have my live stream set up there. I do all my workouts there. I work out pretty much every day. I got a barrel sauna. I got a cold plunge situation inspired by Wim Hof and Laird Hamilton.
Yeah.
And then I have a really great kitchen. I got this room right here, which doubles as like my design studio, fashion design studio, where I like, you know, I do all my clothes, design and all my meetings with my team, which is now just me, you know, Zooming. And I stream out of here. I got my studio downstairs. it's just like now my day is so full and I just go from one room to the next room to the next room. And it's just become, you know, the best quarantine house. I don't even feel like I'm in quarantine. So I, just because I have this luxury, right, I'm trying to, at the very least, one, entertain, you know, anyone that's watching my streams or live, and two, just inspire people to, like, you know, do your workouts. Here's the WADs. And later on, I'm going to do something that I haven't really announced yet, but I could talk here about it. It's I have a foundation called the Aoki Foundation, and we focus on the brain. Our whole mission is about the human brain. Mm-hmm. Learning about the brain, mainly learning about it in every aspect. One, to find cures for degenerative diseases. That's like the main goal, right? Obviously, just to find cures for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, even to the point of depression, like understand what that's all about, anxiety, all those things. And work with organizations that do that. And then two is, you know, unlock the mysteries and the doors of the brain that we can, if we got into, we could do things that would be science fiction. You know, mm-hmm. we could start inching our way towards turning some science fiction concepts into science fact, which is really, that's my passion point, right? You know, like do things like, you know, live through our technology, you know, at the extreme, live yeah. forever through our technology, things like that. So, and work with researchers and orgs that do that. So with the Aoki Foundation, our whole mission at this point, which is about the brain, is mental health. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be planning out, doing this kind of challenge and almost like a noob instruction to certain things that people can do while they're stuck at home, mm-hmm. you know, like breath work, even a cold plunge. Cause everyone's got, you know, if you don't have a bathtub, then I don't know. Then
cold shower.
Your trash can too. Works. Or yeah, obviously cold shower, you know, meditation, yoga. I already did the exercise. So and nutrition, obviously, and then bring on experts and talk about these things to the fans, to, you know, especially to the younger demo. Cause mm-hmm. I feel like as you get older, you pick these things up, at, you know, as our mortality starts increasing. But when you're young, when I was young, I thought I was invisible, you know, invincible. Yeah. You know what I mean? So like, it's kind of like feeding the right stuff. Then you're just going to, you know, you're going to have, you know, it's just better for you.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually in person and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual. On Purpose with Jay Shetty is brought to you by Booking.com, Booking.yeah. Many of you know that one of the most important aspects of my life is my connection with others. Travel has become one of the best ways for me to connect with people, whether that be my community, my family, friends, or loved ones, or all of you. Most of my family lives outside of the US, so traveling around the holidays, birthdays, or other special occasions is something that we're accustomed to. As we grow older, oftentimes our families or loved ones end up living in different areas as us, making it challenging to get together due to various schedules and commitments. With Booking.com, I'm able to efficiently book travel and accommodations for everyone in my family, so that we can spend quality time together. They also make it easy to book travel for the various types of travelers in my family, so that each person in my family can authentically be the traveler they want to be, no matter the destination. Once a year, my family takes a trip together to a US destination where none of us live or are visited. We find this helpful in making sure that everyone is truly present and able to unplug from their normal routines. resulting in more meaningful conversations and connections. Experiencing new places with those close to you allows you to bond over a shared experience. Booking.com's breadth and variety of accommodations in the US has made the destination selection and booking process not only easy, but fun. Travel can also foster new connections. Visiting different cities has allowed me to build connections with all of you, my community, most of whom I've never met in person and otherwise would have not crossed paths with. The in-person relationships that are built and strengthened through travel is something that each of us can benefit from. Book whoever you want to be on booking.com, booking.yeah. Herbs hold a special place in my wellness journey, a tradition deeply rooted in my Indian heritage. Introduced to me by my mom, their healing properties have been part of my life since I was born. Growing up, I witnessed firsthand the remarkable effects of herbs on both physical and mental well-being. Among the herbs I take are ashwagandha for its adaptogenic properties, slippery elm bark for gastrointestinal health. Our sponsor Nature's Way has these herbs and hundreds more that help support everything from healthy digestion to sleep to stress. They have over 50 years of experience with sourcing herbs from all over the world in the climates where they grow best. Every batch of herbs is rigorously tested for potency and purity in their state-of-the-art lab. Nature's Way believes nature is the ultimate problem solver and is dedicated to bringing the power of plants to help people live healthier lives. To learn more, visit naturesway.com/herbs and use code J10 at checkout for our 10% off any herbal supplements. Terms and conditions apply, valid through June 30th.
I think that's good. That's really good to hear. And I like how much synergy there is in the Aoki Foundation and the work that I'm trying to do, because my book that comes out in September, it's called Think Like a Monk. And what I've done is I've found, so I lived as a monk for 3 years in India. And so I've got every lesson that I learned as a monk, but I found all the modern science that backs up those statements. So I don't know if you've ever seen any scans on monks' brains. It's phenomenal. Like the neuroscience behind a monk's brain that's meditated for 4 to 5 decades is just phenomenal. Wow. To the point that you can, there are studies done where monks have been put under physical pain, where the parts of their brain that show physical pain light up, but there's no emotional pain associated with the physical pain. So for most of us, we experience pain in two forms. We experience the pain of burn or hurt, and then we associate pain with that physical pain, so it hurts us mentally and emotionally. But for these monks that they scanned their brains, they found that they only felt the physical pain, but zero emotional pain, which is like insane to comprehend. And I talk about it in the book. So I'm excited to share that. Yeah, I'm excited to share that with you when it drops.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I love that, like what you just said, that combining the science, you know, behind the practice, you know, because like, obviously, like without the science, it already looks really great because you're just so relaxed. But I want to know what's happening up here. I want to know what's happening in the body.
Me too.
And because like, once you know that kind of information, that raw data, I mean, then like you could do so much more. Like, totally. how you can like ask the questions that can actually dive deeper into our psyche, deeper into finding that place that we're trying to find. So it's the data is incredible. I mean, that you're combining both of that.
Yeah. I find that the parallel, the juxtaposition between timeless wisdom and modern science is so fun, because there's a great thought from Martin Luther King where he said, if you want a new idea, read an old book. And I love that kind of like finding that synergy between like, this was said 5,000 years ago, but it's being proven through data and insight today. And therefore it's relevant to you and me, and it's repeatable and scalable, and we can share it across the whole world. Right. And like, I love what you said about turning science fiction into science fact. I think that's brilliant, because I think you're so right that so many of us, when we're watching science fiction, even if it has a message or it has powerful storylines or plots or characters, we all go, but that's fake, right? That's not real. And I think you're so right that if we can try and push people along the way to show them that it's actual fact, it's actually possible, that makes people feel it's possible in their own lives.
That's like, science fiction is our imagination on steroids, right? Science fiction is like, it's like, what can we what would be the wildest dream scenarios? And let's put that into, you know, illustration or comics or a TV show or, you know, animation, whatever it might be. And you just take that imagination that we all have, that we're all excited about. As a species, we're here 2020 alive out of all the other bipedal species because of our imagination, large part, you know, because we dream for more, you know, we imagine things. And some of those things can actually happen by doing the right steps. So it's like, you know, just like the, like certain ideas, like telekinesis, you know, moving things with your mind.
Yeah.
You say that to someone and they're like, well, that's obviously impossible. You can't just be like, and then like, you know, my keyboard lifts up.
Yeah.
But you can actually, telekinesis exists now.
Mm-hmm.
But in a different context, in a way where, you know, people that have paralysis, that are paralyzed, have technology in their brain connecting to a computer, and it's able to, what their thoughts are able to move, you know, the machine that they're sitting on forward or to the left, or bring like a robotic arm with food to their face.
Yeah.
That's moving with your mind. You're moving with your mind. You're not saying anything. You're not moving with your hands. That's telekinesis. Mm-hmm. That's our version of telekinesis.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. It's just like those kinds of things that like we use technology to actually make some of these imaginations into reality. And whenever that happens, whenever those two things happen, they collide, I want to be there. I want to see it, you know, or I want to participate somehow, you know.
You want to be a fly on the wall. You want to be involved.
I mean, like in some cases, I want to be the test dummy, you know. I want to be the guinea pig. Like, yeah. You know, not all cases, but in some cases, I'm like, let me try this out.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual. On Purpose with Jay Shetty is brought to you by Booking.com, Booking.yeah. Many of you know that one of the most important aspects of my life is my connection with others. Travel has become one of the best ways for me to connect with people, whether that be my community, my family, friends, or loved ones, or all of you. Most of my family lives outside of the US, so traveling around the holidays, birthdays, or other special occasions is something that we're accustomed to. As we grow older, oftentimes our families or loved ones end up living in different areas as us, making it challenging to get together due to various schedules and commitments. With Booking.com, I'm able to efficiently book travel and accommodations for everyone in my family so that we can spend quality time together. They also make it easy to book travel for the various types of travelers in my family so that each person in my family can authentically be the traveler they want to be, no matter the destination. Once a year, my family takes a trip together to a US destination where none of us live or are visited. We find this helpful in making sure that everyone is truly present and able to unplug from their normal routines, resulting in more meaningful conversations and connections. Experiencing new places with those close to you allows you to bond over a shared experience. Booking.com's breadth and variety of accommodations in the US has made the destination selection and booking process not only easy, but fun. Travel can also foster new connections. Visiting different cities has allowed me to build connections with all of you, my community, most of whom I've never met in person and otherwise would have not crossed paths with. The in-person relationships that are built and strengthened through travel is something that each of us can benefit from. Book whoever you want to be on booking.com, booking.yeah. I've got to say, herbs have been a game changer in my wellness routine, all thanks to my Indian upbringing. My mum was the one who got me started on them way back when. I've seen how they can do wonders for both body and the mind. One of my favorites is ashwagandha, which is an adaptogenic herb that helps reduce stress. I usually take it in the morning with my breakfast, and it helps me stay cool, calm, and collected throughout the day. Our sponsor, Nature's Way, has ashwagandha as well as herbs like St. John's wort and holy basil that provide mood and stress support. They have over 50 years of experience sourcing herbs from all over the world in the continents and climates where they grow best. Nature's Way rigorously tests every batch of herbs for potency and purity in their state-of-the-art lab. To learn more, visit naturesway.com/herbs and use code J10 at checkout for 10% off any herbal supplements. Terms and conditions apply, valid through June 30th.
I love that, man. Tell me about the imagination, because imagine going back into that mindset when you were saying, like, you know, LA is where you really broke through, but those early days of your career where it's almost like all you have is your imagination of where things can go to where you are now. And I don't know if you superseded your expectations or met them, but, you know, I think as someone who's like trying to make it, trying to break through, and a lot of people listening and watching, they have that. And today, you know, you're buying your mom a home and she's close by to you, and you have this incredible world that you've created. What was it that was getting you through that time? What was the mindset that you believe served you so well in that journey to where you are now? What was it that you were doing differently that allowed you to break through the noise and the clutter? Because you're so much more than a DJ, you know, and I think that's why what you do is so attractive and so iconic to so many people. Tell me about what that was like on the come up, which people don't see anymore. We just see Steve Aoki, the icon. You don't really see that journey.
So when I moved to LA from Santa Barbara, I had a fork in the road at that point, because I graduated from college and I was in love with academia. And I really wanted to pursue that as well. So I was a women's studies sociology major. And with those majors, you could either go into like social work or something like that, or you go right back in academia and do more research. So, and like a lot of my colleagues in the class, they were going right back to academia. They're going for their PhDs, their masters. So it just seemed like, well, I guess that maybe this is the route I'm supposed to take when I was in college. Just, you know, so deep down this track now. And I'm like respected in my small circle that it allowed me to, you know, like, let's go for it. So I did all the application process, and I think I applied to like 15 different schools or something. And I got rejected to literally almost every single one of them. I realized I'm like, I think I'm hot shit, man. You know, like in front of my 15 other, you know, especially women's studies, it's like, it's all women except for me and this other guy. I'm like, you know, like they all love me. Like I'm going to make it, you know, like through whatever field I'm going to do outside of this. And it was like, nope, 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 nope. Rejection, rejection, rejection. I did get accepted to two, but they're almost like pity. Like it was like a pity. It felt like a pity call. Mm. And then at the same time, I was on my 36th release on Dimmock. Mm. So I was already pumping out music. And I was doing well in college in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
I had a distribution deal, so I didn't have to pay for anything. That was the best thing that could possibly happen to me at that time, because I didn't have any money. So the only way I can make money is if I can deliver good music to the distributor, and they produce everything. They produce the vinyl, they produce the CDs, they distribute it for you, and they give you a check. And then that check allows me to use that money to give to artists so they can record their music, future artists. Mm-hmm. So I was like, sweet, I have a great situation, because I signed some other bands that actually worked out for this distributor. And I was just pumping out music. And then I found this band that was a friend of mine that played in my living room, because I used to put on shows in my living room at the time. I mean, this is like, I'm going to zigzag a little bit, but
I love it. Zigzag as much as you like, man. It's great.
So during this time, which is quite interesting, in college, I had a small apartment. Our living room was like maybe 200, 300 square feet. So I could be a little bit off here, but it was very small. But we had maybe 20 shows a month in that living room. So we would have like maybe 80 bands, because it'd be like four bands a show every single month, like clamoring in there with like 20 people, like moshing and whatever. Give $5 at the door to the band, and I'd be bicycling and doing deliveries, getting paid minimum wage to all the fraternities delivering food. So that's what I was a telemarketer. I was on the phone, like cold calling, poor people to try to do something for UNICEF or something. I don't know what I was, I forgot what it was, but I was doing telemarketing, getting paid that way. And I was a bike messenger, a bike delivery guy. And then I would put on shows. So the reason why I'm going to talk about this is that there, like, a lot of that ideology, that ethos that I had when I was in college, when I was in high school, putting on the shows, because at the time I was putting on shows, I was in bands. Whenever we put on shows, we didn't make a dime. I wrote for a zine, this punk zine, for 7 years. I had a column. I'd write a column about whatever I wanted to write about. And then I reviewed everything under the sun. So whatever, I go in there, there'd be a box of demos and zines and cassettes, if you can remember that, like vinyl. I would say, give me everything. I want to review it all. So I'd review sometimes between 50 to 100 reviews for the zine. And I do this all for free. Like, you never get paid. No one got paid there because it's like punk scene. But it was the Bible for our hardcore community. So I wrote for that zine for five to seven years. Wow. And when the bands I was in, we weren't getting paid. The whole point of this is that I grew up in this culture, in the music world. I grew up in this culture where you're not supposed to profit from what you do. You're supposed to, like, give everything and not actually get anything financial in return. It is not a business. Like, the world I was in, it was not a business, and you can't even actually make it a business. It's like pure passionate people playing to pure passionate people. And it's a very, very, like, small, it's a small little community. And, it's small in that you can't scale it out so much because the music was so, like, niche, but it was small enough for me. And this is where I learned something really valuable, that every contribution I made to the community was meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned at a very, very young age, when I got into hardcore and punk music, that the contributions I made to the community were my cool points. They're the way I got respect. It wasn't like, like wearing the fresh Nikes, going to school and getting that respect, or like having a girl, like, talk to you in front of your friends, getting that respect. It's literally you make a zine, you spend the time, you do the interviews, you go to the Kinko's Copy Center, glue it together, and then make a zine, Xerox everything out, or start a band, or like, whatever it is to contribute to this little world. It's like a religion almost. And we're like, Jehovah's Witness going out there, like letting people know about our world, but not to other people, just to our inside circle.
Yeah.
Right. So I learned that, and there's no financial return. Right. And as a kid, you don't care about financial return, because all you care about is quarters playing in Street Fighter. That's all I care about. I just needed enough quarters that after every day after school, I would go to Moe's Pizzeria, get my slice of pizza, and pump in like three games of Street Fighter. And I was happy, because that's all my mom would ever give me. It's like, here's money for a slice of pizza and some quarters for your video games.
Yeah.
And so I learned that at a young age, and I followed that through with all my friends into college, or the community that was global but small, niche-y. And I would tour. And it just became my life, and I never expected to make money. So after I left college and I hit that fork in the road, we're talking about academia or music, and I decided to go down the music route and do my label. I was like, I have something set up. I don't need to expend too much money, and I could build this band that I just found called The Kills, that were my friends. And like, they're they blew my mind. They were so different from all the punk and emo and the other stuff I was putting out that I love. But this is like, this is a rock and roll band that's like, you know, kind of Velvet Underground-y, got this whole thing to it that can, like, I want to blow them up. Yeah. So I had this passion and I just literally like hung up the guitar and the microphone. I'm like, I'm going to focus entirely on Dimmock, my record label, this band, move to LA and make it happen. So I moved to LA, but I still had the same ideology, right? So really I had zero business acumen. I had no business history. I was, and this is where the double-edged sword begins. Like, I have zero business skills whatsoever. I don't know what the hell I'm doing about making money or how to, you know, I didn't understand what ROI meant. I don't understand how to save money. I just like was like, I'm going to give 100% and I don't really care about the return. Right. So that really affected me later on. A few years later, I was in like major debt. But the other edge of the sword is that I know what I'm doing is what I need to do. Cause this, I will live and die by this, by what I'm doing, you know, regardless of the money. The money was like so not important to me. It is definitely not the right business to make money in, you know, especially for a young kid that has no idea what he's doing with that world. And that's why at that time too, another parallel, my father, who is a successful restaurateur, and he founded Benihana's, and he was very wealthy and he's very, you know, showy with his wealth. He actually never gave me a dime.
Wow.
Never gave me a dime. I wouldn't say just me. He never gave any of his kids a dime. That's like how he was raised, because he was raised, he was a working class man when his family's working class when they were in Japan. My mom was broke when she was in Japan. So my mom was very thrifty already because she grew up that way. My dad was just like, one, what you're doing is a distraction to what you need to do is get a real job. You know, like work at 9 to 5. Life is supposed to be boring. You're supposed to deal with it because that's life. You can't just have fun all the time and think you're going to get by and you're gonna be broke. And guess what? No one's going to help you, Steve. No one's going to help you. You need to learn your lesson. I'm not going to be throwing you a lifeline. You better figure this out. You better get a job. And I'm an adult now. You can't tell me what I can't do.
Yeah. Finding that courage from? Where are you finding that confidence from to kind of follow yours?
I've been reared through my whole, like, this is exactly why I went back to my high school and college days. I've been reared. I am I'm steel. Like, no one could take me away from this. I don't care if I'm broke. I really don't care. I don't care if I was living in a small apartment. I mean, like when I moved to LA, me and my girlfriend moved there together at the time, my ex-girlfriend. And it was $900 apartment. We spent $450 each. And, you know, my cost of living was so low. It was like top ramen and, you know, just like whatever we could do to get by my phone bill, my car insurance. So like my total cost was like $800, you know? So I was like, okay, I can handle that. My mom did help me out a little bit with that part because I had no money. So, you know, and my dad would not help me because that's just how he is. And I applaud him and I thank him. He's passed away, but I thank him so much for that because I learned myself. And, you know, he was very much that tough love kind of father. And I'm so, so, so grateful for that. That's one thing I'm going to take with me when I have kids too, is they need to learn on their own.
Yeah.
They need to figure that out on their own. So in any case, when I started Dimmock and I started, you know, hustling, no matter what the records I put out would sell, I was also expending just the same amount. So the business side was to shit, you know, and I was learning far beyond the hard way because I was losing so much. You know, I was like, my credit cards were maxed out. I was getting on more credit cards and there's no way out. Like at one point after a few years, and this is after I signed like some huge bands like Block Party. Like after I found Block Party, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make it. It's not like I'm going to be rich because I didn't really care about being rich. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to be a self-sustainable label. That's what I wanted to be, a self-sustainable business that can run and have employees, because I didn't have any employees.
Yeah.
I just had a bunch of interns. I got my first employee in 2003 when we found Block Party, you know, and I was like, I need to pay her and I got to pay. Yeah. I got to deal with this. And like my poor girlfriend is like 13 interns in the house, you know, in the apartment when she comes home from work. So anyways, you know, fast forward, I'm signing some really big acts and still I am not, I am like now at this point, 10 cards, maxed out, $100,000 in debt. And then I started throwing these dim mac parties because what I did was like, oh, I'm going to replicate. And this is like the saving grace situation. So I'm going to replicate the same thing I did in my living rooms and in high school at these house parties, but I'm going to do that in LA at these bars. And I'm not going to be in a band because that LA culture, nightlife culture, if you want to do it all the time, it's like these little bars. Right. Mm. So, I learned how to DJ. My friend got me my first gig just playing some vinyl records. And then I started DJing at these small little bars, and we would make them these dim mac parties. And then we would bring Block Party in, we would bring the Kills in, we would bring in other bands too, that I was friends with, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs to, you know, Mars Volta to, you know, at the drive-in plate in my apartment. So like Mars Volta was that their new band. They would come in to the Shins, to the Killers, I mean, before they blew up. And then we would have them DJ for literally $100. And I was the opening DJ because I was a nobody, right? So I was getting a bar tab at first, just while people were trickling. In the beginning, I would set up because I didn't have a setup. I didn't have turntables, and I was DJing vinyl. I had vinyl records because that's what I did when I collected records as a punk and hardcore kid. What you do, part of the culture, is you collect records. So I had a bunch of records and I was playing those records and I was like, I got to buy hip hop records. I got to buy indie records. I got to buy electronic records. And so I started buying records and I was playing them, you know, learning how to beat match before the doors open. And as people would trickle in, they would hear me train wreck and just be like the worst DJ on the planet. But I was promoting the party so they couldn't kick me out. Right. And I'm only doing it for bar tabs. So they just have to deal with me for the first 30 minutes or first hour. And I did that over and over and over and over again. And I finally got better at DJing. I went from playing, you know, like opening to like one slot up, getting, you know, $50 to $75, including my bar tab, very important at the time. And then we started building a network of bands coming through. Every time a band would come through, MIA to whoever, we would have their party. And then I was already doing my label. So I was already connected to so many other artists and managers and other record labels that we started growing a little culture in LA, this dim mac culture, this culture that where we were helping foster and be a developing platform for up and coming artists. And then soon it went to hip hop. Soon it went to Kid Cudi. And Kid Cudi was coming through. Kanye West was coming through. Lady Gaga did her first shows in LA. To Skrillex, to LMFAO. Will.i.am was always there. When Black Eyed Peas was making those hits 10 years ago, they were at our party every single time we threw a party. And soon I was making, you know, from 50 to 200 to 500. And then I was DJing like four times a week. So you got to think, I eventually did pay off all my debt, but it wasn't it was from like some offshoot that I did not think was going to happen. And that was DJing and becoming, you know, I wouldn't say the DJ Steve Aoki saved the day. It was really the Steve Aoki that's trying to help build this small culture outward, but realize that, you know, this culture has no boundaries.
Yeah. And what were the values of that culture that you were trying to build? Like, what was in your mindset? What was like the underpinning foundations of that culture that was so powerful to you? Like, what were those values?
The underpinning ideology of the culture is that for me, as someone that's involved, that wants to be involved, is it's the same feeling of signing a brand new act that you want to share to the world.
Mm.
So it's like when you really break that down, when you boil that down,
yes,
it's the excitement, just like when you're a kid and you share something to a friend.
Yeah.
It's like, yo, Eddie, I just found this toy.
Yeah, or a movie.
You gotta fuck with this toy. And then Eddie picks up like, oh my God, I'm like, I can't stop playing with the toy. It's that ability to share, that excitement to share with people. That's where I feel like my strong suit is.
Yeah.
Like behind like all this stuff, it's all I care about is sharing things I love.
Yeah.
Okay. And then now I'm finding ways to monetize that. But if you put money in front of that, then like that ability to share doesn't have that same feeling, right?
You have to
share first, right? You have to share first. And if they love it, then like it's just part of how it works. They should pay for it, you know, or they should taste it and pay for it. You know, like you like a piece of the pie, here's a sample, but you can buy the whole pie if you like the pie. You know, but this pie is the motherfucking best pie you'll ever eat in your goddamn life kind of pie, you know?
Yeah, and that's it. If you believe it, and I think that's half the challenge is when you're trying to sell stuff you don't believe, or you're just trying to sell for the sake of selling, it doesn't have that effect or impact because people can feel that, right? When you genuinely are obsessed with something or excited about it, like you said, the kids example is perfect because whether it's a new video game or a new movie or the latest thing that happened, that infectious feeling that we all get as children,
yeah,
just want to tell our best friends about that. But you have this really interesting perspective of aiming high but managing your expectations. And I wonder how you were doing that at that time and how people could do that, because obviously you've exceeded and superseded many expectations, like you said. And I love what you said about your father, because it's so beautiful that you've turned that into gratitude and that you're seeing it from a grateful angle, because, you know, it's so easy for so many people to be bitter towards their parents for not supporting their dreams or not giving them money or not believing in them. But I think that you're teaching us a really valuable lesson here, because actually, you're so right that because of that lack of support, and it's interesting for me to think about that, because when I came back from the monastery and any other people that came back too, we were all in the same position. We had zero. And I came back to parents who didn't have a lot, who couldn't give me a lot. And a lot of my friends came back to parents who had lots of money. And it's really interesting to see the trajectories of the two types of people, that often that can be so crippling when you have too many resources. So I love that perspective of gratitude. But tell us about how you've always been able to aim high but manage expectations. And what does that mean now? And how has that evolved for you?
Yeah, I'm actually trying to think about the first, you know, striking time of aiming high and managing your expectations. I mean, I think... Let me tell you a story first before.
Yeah, it's
like second nature to me. So for me to like understand like why or how I do it is I need to tell a story first. So I remember, I guess when you sign certain, before I was a DJ, when I signed certain acts that blew up, I wasn't necessarily aiming high. I was just working with other underground talent. Right. So that wouldn't be a good example, but one would be, I remember I only managed one artist in my whole career. I've only actually managed one artist. It was in 2004, and there was this young singer, and she had this video that just blew my mind, and she got already on the cover of Fader magazine. So, and Fader magazine is like the ultra cool, like, yeah, okay, you got to check out this artist. And my friend worked for Fader. He was the editor there, editor in chief there. And he interviewed Dimmock as one of the rising labels at the time. So he's like, you got to check out this artist. You know, she needs help in America. She's like just blown up in England. And I listened to her music and I saw her video and I was just like, holy shit. She's a superstar. She's a superstar. She's going to change the world. Like, I just was like, I've kind of fell to my knees like this, you know, first of all, I need to sign her if possible, because I already got block party. So I'm like, I have like some cachet. So, and then I reached out to her and I was like, can I sign you? It's like, no, we're already signed to XL for the world. We can't do that. And XL's, you know, they signed Adele. They have like, they're one of the giant indie labels. Great, great, amazing indie label. So obviously I'm small. I'm just like, I just believe in you so much. I might not have the infrastructure, but I have my passion for to like help you grow to be who you want to be is like insane. I will topple everyone on that energy level. And she's like, well, I love your energy, but you can't sign me, but you know, we can do something else. I'm like, okay, can I manage you then? I've never managed a single artist in my life. It's like, I need to work with this woman, you know? Yeah. And then she's like, I love that energy and I haven't felt that energy. So yes, you can manage me, Erica. And I was just flipping in my head. Like, I'm like, oh my God, I'm a fucking manager now. This is amazing.
Did you play it cool in person or were you as excited in person as well?
Yeah, I was playing it cool, but like I was showing it for sure, you know, but not to the level that I should. That would like throw her, you know, tell her to have her walk away. But anyway, so I started like working with her and it only lasted for 3 months because I mean, I knew it was to a certain extent what I'm supposed to do. But I did aim high. I did aim high there.
Yeah.
And you know, I tried my best to the skill set and level that I knew. And I did, like, I have to say a little bit of it came from me in the very, very beginning. She did it all herself. She's a incredibly intelligent. She's just like an amazing, absolutely amazing, inspirational woman. And she goes by the name of MIA.
No, wow.
Yeah. So, I just was obsessed with her, but I'd say that was like one of the first times where I really aimed high, but I felt confident that I could do it because like I would do absolutely anything to make it happen, you know? So I think that's where it is. That's the soul of what we're talking about is that if you really, really, truly believe that you're the best person, that you could apply something that other people can't apply. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily mean like you're the most well-rounded, you have the best infrastructure, you have the most money. It's more about like you have the heart to really take it to the next level. Aim for that, you know, also obviously aim for that. And then realize when as someone on the other receiving end, if I see a kid coming at me with that same kind of heart, I mean, I'm going to feel him. I'm going to feel her. I'm going to be like, okay, I want this person on the team, but not necessarily as a top.
Yes.
But I'll find a way to include them in. And that's where the managing expectations comes in. You fight for the top and then you understand what your level of expertise is in that space. So that's when you're like, okay, understandably, I'll start at level one, but I'm at least in, and then you grow up.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man. Thanks for telling that story. That literally, that story crystallizes the point so well.
Yeah,
and it's brilliant. And anyone who's listening, you can tell that Steve's a phenomenal storyteller, and his memoir, Blue, The Color of Noise, which he recently released, highly recommended because it's the same. These stories that you can dive into with much more depth and you get to extrapolate them. So for anyone who's listening and going, wow, I need to know more about this incredible person's life, then make sure you check out Blue, The Color of Noise. It was recently released. It was Steve's memoir. Steve, I want to talk a bit about Neon Future 4 because, you know, it's out right now. I believe it's streaming and people can listen to it and get it. It's got 27 tracks on it. Now, what stood out to me is that I know that Sapiens is one of your favorite books.
Yeah.
Yuval not only is a good friend, but he also came on the podcast and I find him fascinating too. Tell me about how the song Homo Deus came about, because I wouldn't really think of Yuval and music. You know, it's brilliant. That's why I love it. It's so cool. So tell us about how that comes about and where that originates from.
Yeah. So it's also you wouldn't think about Yuval and Neon Future so much, because his version of the future is not neon.
No.
It's utopian. So that's where like I've definitely allowed for various kinds of voices about what the future looks like that are different to mine. Because up until this time, an exception to like J.J. Abrams, who like was more vague about, you know, neon future, it was very much like along the same lines. Like the Ray Kurzweil was very much along the same lines as Neon Future. Neon Future is kind of based on Ray Kurzweil's singularity approach. And Brian Johnson, definitely, he's head of Kernel. And he's got the incredible brain technology. So he's talking about the same kind of thing that I've been saying, as well. But, Yuval is, you know, reading a second book, which is also extremely incredible. You know, it's interesting that, like, you know, technology for us, for Homo sapiens will take it for granted, or take advantage of it in a way that's not good for us. Mm-hmm. But I for every album on Neon Future, I'm approaching scientists, authors, and people that have some like level of, or some story that they're talking about with the future. And and I needed to get Yuval on this after I read Sapiens. I had to get Yuval on this after I read Homo Deus.
Yeah.
But you know, it was a bit difficult. He wasn't like coming with ease, you know. It wasn't like pulling teeth so much, but it was definitely like, I don't know if this is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm still crossing my fingers kind of thing. Like until it happened, I'm like, did it really come in? his voice bite, did it really come in? I mean, and when it came in, it was like, it was as if like Drake vocals came in. You know, it was as if like Post Malone's vocals
showed up
in my inbox. Like I'm like, I have Yuval Harari on the album. So that was heavy for me. That was really big. Because like to me, yeah, it's just, you know, I go just like you're talking about, I go for the heavyweights as high as possible, you know. Mm-hmm. And Yuval is my favorite author.
Yeah.
So I go for as high as I can go, and then kind of like step sideways, and then step down, sideways, down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I feel like the thing too is I'm confident about me. I'm confident about my music, mm-hmm. and more importantly, music connects the world. That's one thing you can't take away. That's one thing that has nothing to do with opinion. It just,
yeah. Music's the world's language. It's the world's language.
It's an emotional language.
Yeah.
That's the thing about music is it's an emotional language, and depending on the song, it could change your life.
Mm.
You know, so, and artists have changed my life, you know, like I know songs that have taken people from the gutter and made them feel alive.
Yeah.
Changed their entire life, you know? And, I think we can all appreciate that. So it's like, you know, if like, you know, I'm not sure if he's a Steve Aoki listener, but, I think he agrees on the music portion,
yeah.
Of, you know?
Oh, for sure. For sure. The fact that he came through means that he believes in you and your work, and that he believes that, you know, music has the ability to transform the world. And it's so thrown around, but you're so right about it being an emotional language. And tell us about that. Like what, because it's so interesting, especially we're talking about it right now. I think sound and this, I talk a lot about this during our time as living as monks, like sound and sound design was so important to how we lived our lives. So we always woke up in the morning to nature sounds, whether it was a stream or whether it was the birds or whether it was, you know, it was always something natural. And then our meditations were full of gongs and cymbals, like, and they were tuned perfectly to a resonance that was helped to get you into a deeper state of meditation, right? Each of the mantras that were chanted at a specific vibration to have a physical, emotional, and mental and deeper effect. And so I'm totally sold on sound design, especially when I lived in New York City and all I heard was drilling and digging and all of that. And you're like, wow, this sound design or this sound distraction is really messing up my brain. Whereas sound design. So, and right now I think because people are stuck in their homes, sound is so important. What is the sounds of Neon Future? What is your goal? And what kind of feeling or what emotion are you trying to bring about in people through the music, through each of the tracks?
I want a dynamic experience with the album. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to bring all the different colors to the table, different personalities. And that's what music is. It's just like all these emotional personalities. So that's why when you, if you listen to the album from front to back, mm-hmm. it goes through all these different tempos, these different arrangements, moods, and it changes up. Like some songs are extremely like blind happiness, you know, like I Love My Friends, and some songs are just dark and visceral and like, you know, should be in a you know, a thriller or a sci-fi film or something, you know. Yeah. I really want to take people on that kind of journey because it's 27 songs. So if you're going to really sit there and you're going to go into this album, then yes, I needed like give you a lot of texture, you know, and, you know, like my previous albums, I consider them chapters, you know, they're like between 10 and 14 songs. This is 27. And it's also just different genres. I mean, it's just
so different.
Right. So like on, just on that note alone, just on like outside the feeling perspectives that we're talking about, it's, you know, having, you know, Spanish on there, having a K-pop group on there, Maluma yeah, on there, you know, to, you know, Zooey Deschanel, to, you know, just like all these different kinds of artists, it just like throws curveballs at you, which is what I prefer, instead of like you hear four or five songs into it and you're like, wow, they all sound the same, you know, in the end, because they all have, they're all the same tempo, the same arrangement, the same like, you know, punchline, the same whatever it is. Then you start kind of forgetting. So I kind of want to like mix it up. It's like almost like a DJ set. Like, yeah, you know, like back in the day when I used to DJ before I was producing so much, I would play Dolly Parton into Daft Punk into, you know, Elvis Costello into Block Party, but actually mix them, find ways to mix them into like the Ramones. You know, like
yeah,
want to mix things up in a way that makes people go, oh,
yeah, yeah,
have fun and go back into their childhood, go back to, or like a song they heard yesterday to like, you know, and that's like, it's like what I've learned about being a DJ is the attention span of crowds and yeah, how to get their attention if I'm losing them, you know?
Yeah.
And this album is like a very similar approach, but they're all brand new songs. So I have to find new ways to keep them engaged because it is a book. It's like, it's heavyweight, you know, 27 songs is heavyweight. And then most people, majority of people won't be listening to it straight, but I made it. So I made these songs, the grout of the songs, the songs that glue Neon Future together, not just as an album, but as a whole series are all my science based songs, all the songs with Yuval, Brian Johnson, Ray Kurzweil, JJ Abrams, Kip Thorne, Aubrey de Grey, and so forth.
Yeah. Do you ever experience a creative block ever? And if you do, or how do you process that? What do you do to get out of those, or do you go into them? Like, what is your process? Because I love asking that to highly creative people who are able to, like I said, connect all these ideas, but what does a creative block look like for you? And how do you process it?
Creative blocks, they're camouflaged. They're hard to discern. And they're tricky beasts.
Mm.
They're tricky because like I'll work on a record for a long time and I'll think I'm getting there. And then like at the 12th hour, I'm like, I have to restart the whole thing. This is like literally, it just keeps like the carrot still at the end of the stick going, keep going, keep going, keep going. And then I'm just like, why is this not sound right? What the like, you know?
Yeah.
And then like you go back into it again and you don't want to give up on all that work. You spent 12 hours on an idea and it's so fleshed out and you literally might have to restart the whole thing again. You know how painful that is?
Yeah, that is not.
That's like the thing with like music and this kind of art creation. It's like, depending, if you're experimental, you can kind of flow with it, I guess. But if you have a certain goal in mind that's very specific, you know, especially with collaborations, I have to tend to the other artists that are involved. I can't just experiment, you know? And also, like, my soul won't let me just be like, oh, I'm okay with it. It's fine. I just, like, my gut is like, you better start again. You have the work ethic. You better start again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, that happens a lot more than you think. It happens a lot. And you have to, that's, I think, the one of the understated qualities of a great producer is dealing with that, managing that you have to restart and be okay with that and not give up and not like, you know, it's frustrating. It's a frustrating situation that you have to deal with regardless of the situation.
Totally.
I have songs on Neon Future 4 that the one beat, one music, the whole melody, I changed the drums, but like the drum arrangement, the melodies, everything I wrote in 2013.
Wow.
Released until 2020.
That's crazy.
And that was done. It was done in 2013. Actually, I'll tell you right now, I haven't told anybody this. That beat was for Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, because we did a tour together for 3 weeks. And so we were working in his studio on the bus. And he's like just on it, you know. And I'm like, yo, I got this specific beat just for you. And I played it for him, but I don't think he wanted it. He was like, oh, yeah, it's cool. And then, you know, we went on our ways. But I made it for him. And then I sat on it and I kept on trying to revisit it through the years. And then finally I got, you know, a great vocal on it and now it's put out. So there's two songs like that where in the reverse side of things, I had a vocal top line because I have so many vocals in my computer from so many different sessions I've had. And this one, I just can't toss. So it's been sitting there for 7 years and finally was able to turn into a song.
That's amazing. What I find fascinating about that is your ability to build something for someone, it not going as predicted, and then you're able to still let that live for 7 years and then have its own moment that it obviously deserves. Like, what's going through your mind at that time? Like, how are you focusing on failure or rejection and then going, oh, actually, this still has a place and it can evolve into something useful and great and beautiful?
Failure, rejection, working with artists, that takes time. How do you deal with that? You just deal with it the best you can. I mean, like the first times it hits you hard, just like anything. And then like, you just get kind of, you get okay to it later on, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's just with anything. But like, there's times when I have had songs with huge artists that literally were about to come out and boom, nope, it's not coming out. So I've had to get to that point where, you know, like I am dying for this record to come out. And I'm like, please, just like when the clock hits 12, it's out. I'm like, okay, no one stopped it. Because anything could happen, like especially with big artists that you work with, management, maybe the artists themselves, they're like temperamental. They're like, no, I don't like it. I don't want to do this, you know? Yeah. I mean, even Kanye's done, he's like changed music after he's dropped the records, you know? He's like, the album's out and he's like taking them down and retooling them and putting them back up again.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, you know, there's a lot of different possibilities that can stunt or like stop something from happening. And you can have an incredible relationship with an artist and you have that bond and make music, which I've had tons of songs, and then all of them get locked up. All of them. Yeah. All of them.
That's a lot to deal with.
And then the artist goes like this and you're like, well, we have hits. We have hits, you know? And it's like, that hurts no matter if I've been doing this for, you know, now or if I just started producing. It's like it just hurts really bad, you know, because these are testaments of your life that you can get out to the world that like leave, like my, like why I do this is I want people to like vibe on it. I want people to feel it like the way I feel it. And like especially the combination between me and this particular artist, like that's gonna blow people's minds away. And just nope, sorry, ain't gonna happen. And I still have songs that are like, I'm like doing this right now. that I've done, finish songs with artists that are just massive. I can't talk about, and I'm just like, please have it come out, because it's just been radio silence, you know?
Yeah, no, I get that. And that's, I feel you on that. Just hearing, I can hear how much is in your voice and the way you're sharing it like that. And I love the honesty and the genuineness of you just saying it still hurts. Like, it's not, because it's your heart, like your heart's in it. So it hurts. It's not like you're putting out stuff that you don't care about. It's there's meaning attached to each of it. And there's a part of your life in each of those songs. And when it doesn't come out, that feels like a part of your life that's been missed or lost and left.
So to somewhat answer the question, because I just complained a lot, but like,
it was great. It was a great answer, but go on.
But I say the only way you could deal with that is by doing more.
Yeah.
You know, the only way you could deal with it is just by just being, you know, it's like, you just got to be active. You just got to keep going. You can't just sulk. That's life though. That's just a lesson of life. It's like, don't sulk.
Yeah.
Just move forward. Move forward. Do things. I don't even know if that's the right answer. Cause like, you know, talking to someone like you, you might be like, you just need to meditate and let the emotions not affect you. They're just feelings and thoughts that aren't real. You know, with me, like the way I am is kind of the opposite. I'm like, everything, let's go. I'm just like running, and like and then my therapist is like, you can't just run and like go through life like that. You need to sit and like face it, confront it, and know that it doesn't affect you. And I'm just like, I just want to do another song right now. I'm gonna do another song. I'm gonna call this artist. I'm gonna be like, you know, it's like if someone, you know, if you go through a breakup, you're like, oh, I gotta call the girls that liked me once, you know, or whatever. Like, can I get that? I need to get like my ego back up again or something.
I love that, man. No, it's great. And I think it's a bit of both. You know, there's sometimes you got to sit with an emotion and you got to deal with it. There's sometimes you got to push through. Like, it's different, right? There's never one size fits all for every challenge. There's different.
Yeah,
and failure. So I think you're spot on. I agree with you. It's, you know, it's what works for you and what helps you shift. There are times when sitting with something that's been, I think when something's recurring, when there's an emotion that's recurring and there's a feeling that keeps coming back, that's like a repeated lesson that we're not learning. And so that's something you want to sit with. But when it's just random things going on, you just got to dive through sometimes. When we talked about your foundation earlier, I was fascinated by what piece of research or insight that you've learned about the mind or the brain that has changed the way you live in a particular part of your life. Like, is there one insight or one study or research that when you heard that you're like, oh, that's going to change how I live? Because, you know, you've lived a crazy, you've traveled a lot. Like you said, you've done like 300 shows in a year, or, you know, crazy amounts of shows in a year. You're always on the move. What has been that one piece of research that has changed a lifestyle habit or changed the practice in your life that you are really happy that you found out and discovered about the brain?
I think one of the first things I learned that was profound to me was just the brain plasticity, you know, just that general understanding that you're not necessarily fixed to what you think you're fixed to. You know, you can change things around and be agile and change bad habits and create good habits. That basic understanding is, I think, has been really important to my life, you know. And it allows me to like always think about things like, why am I always doing the same thing? Why do I always do that? I'm going to change it. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to eat like the same breakfast every single morning because I'm just so used to it. I'm not going to sit in the same seat on the couch. You know, like, you always sit in the same area of the couch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. At the dining table, like, in bed,
like, you know, like, I told my girlfriend, hey, I'm going to sleep on your side one night.
What did she say?
She's like, no. No, but I'm just like, it's just like, you always do the same things. So it's like, I think it's good to like kind of be like, no, we're going to do something completely different just to fuck with our brain.
Yeah.
And like the idea, I like the idea or the visual of, you have like, your brain's got these neurotransmitters like just flying across everywhere. And when you do something over and over again, it just becomes this freeway.
Yes.
Of this like canal.
Yes.
Dug in from the wind of, you know, just all of a sudden it's just like firing. And you, in order to change that, it requires one little canal to be built up on the other side.
Totally.
You got to create that freeway. And then soon this like becomes a drought.
Yeah.
It fills in, the sand fills in and it's no longer a freeway anymore. I love that, you know, that like visual of like yellow, blue lines, like doof, 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 doof. And you're like, shit, a bad habit. That's a bad habit. And it's stuck in there real good.
Totally.
We gotta like start creating this little one, but it's gonna take time to start shoveling through that area, and it's gonna take a lot of manpower to get through that, you know?
100%. Yeah, I always describe it as like when you first have a thought and it's a baby thought, it starts off as like a wooden bridge. And then that wooden bridge turns into a stone bridge. And that stone bridge, as you cross it more and more, it turns into a steel bridge. And now you've got this steel bridge of conditioning and the pattern that you can't break anymore until, like you said, you've got to start building that little narrow, that walkway, that little, you know, it's going to start. You're going to start taking that one and building that one. And so we've got these steel bridges like implanted into our mind that are doing the default version of our unconscious life. And you're so right that sometimes we try and bulldoze it. Like we try and get like a destruction company to come and wreck it. It's kind of like Inception, you know, that scene where they've got that train that flies through the city. And it's like, it doesn't work like that. It just starts with a little, like you're a perfect way, just like a little walkway just to keep strengthening that. No, I love that, man. That's a great, great one for everyone to think about, because we want this big change to happen, but that big change starts with just finding that small connection in our mind. So I love that, man. And tell us about, so we were speaking about earlier that, you know, we have a mutual friend and obviously one of your partners, Tom Bilyeu, who's awesome behind the interviews of Impact Theory and Quest Bars as a co-founder originally, but also both of you built Neon Future together. Tell me about how music and comics came together and why you saw that as such a fascinating form of storytelling.
Well, Neon Future definitely is a story that needed to be told. It started as a music narrative in the beginning, because that's just how I'm creative. So, I'm obsessed with this idea of, you know, our humanity converging with technology in a way where we just do all these amazing ideas that we're talking about, science fiction and science fact. And I was talking about this with Tom on his, Impact, or not Impact Theory, right? And we sat down, actually, just before that was for Quest, Inside Quest.
Oh yeah, Inside Quest. That was what it was called before.
We talked on that show and we were talking about all kinds of stuff like that, like living through our technology, you know, uploading our consciousness, stuff like that, like, you know, sci-fi stuff that potentially, who knows, could happen. And then I told him that I'm getting cryonically frozen. So, you know, just that's my insurance policy, that if we don't reach it to that place in my timeline and I die, then, you know, I'll come back. And when that time happens. So, I mean, I'm already dead. So you have, the way I see it is like, you're dead anyway. So I'll still have like a gravesite or, you know, whatever people can see with like my hair or something, you know. Like, I mean, no one's going to see the body anyways, whether you're cremated or you're buried. So I'm already dead and like, but I'm frozen. So that's how I see it. Yeah. You know?
That's amazing, man. I love that. That's
true. He was like shocked by that, but in a good way. And then we just sat down and we're like, yo, we got to build out this Neon Future idea. We got to do something together. And I'm like, this is exactly what I'm looking for. A partner that feels the same way, that can help put this on paper and build out a storyline that we both agree on, that it's like we're flipping the whole, you know, the traditional sci-fi storyline on its head. Because usually the robots are the bad guys, you know. The technology is killing you. Technology, and then like, you know, one human saves the day.
Yeah.
But whereas the augmented, the humans that have, you know, technology in them, because essentially we will become more like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we are like a pretty much, you know, half Android, you know, by the way we use our technology, our phone and stuff. Soon it'll be in our bodies.
Yeah.
And we'll be okay with that. And And that's what the place that I want to start is that those are the good guys, and we're trying to, you know, do good for the world kind of thing. And then the story evolves from there.
But yeah, good, man.
Yeah, it's an incredible storyline. We've produced 6 comics. We just dropped a trade paperback edition, 240 pages, which is awesome. And then we were just on the phone. We're just on Zoom just recently because we're getting through the next 5 issues. So six issues. So excited for the next series of Neon Future to come out.
Yeah, me too, man. I'm always glad I get my delivery. They look great. They're awesome. And congrats on all the awesome work. This has been great, Steve. We end every On Purpose episode with 2 segments. One's called Fill in the Blanks and the Final 5. These are our fast fire, quick fire rounds. So they're 1-word answers, maximum 3 words, 1 sentence. No one ever follows the rules, but let's see how it goes. So this is called Fill in the Blanks. So I'm going to read a sentence and you just got to fill in the blank at the end of the sentence. So it goes, the human experience is based on...
This is not harder than it looks, by the way.
It's much harder than it looks. When I get phenomenal answers, it's like, okay, the human experience is based on.
The human experience is based on just 1 word.
Or like finishing off the sentence, you can fill in the blank.
I might just play dumb here. I'm just going to, the human experience is based on.
Take as much time as you like.
Human experience. It's like writing a caption.
Literally.
You know how hard it is to write a stupid caption? I'm like, delete. No.
That's exactly what it is.
The human experience is based on our connection with each other through our shared experiences.
Yeah. Beautiful. That makes sense. All right, second one.
My music will never not inspire you.
Beautiful. Building a community starts with?
Good grit and scotch tape.
I love it. Connection to me means?
Absolutely everything that I do.
I wish everyone knew.
Oh.
I love how seriously you're taking this. I really appreciate it. I want you to know that. You by far have given us no soft answers. It's great. I respect it and I want to point it out.
I'm not a fast one-liner guy. You
it's
know?
Good. It's
what,
good.
What's the statement again?
I wish everyone knew.
I wish everyone knew that this hair is not real. It's a wig.
You're joking. Now you're playing with me.
I'm kidding.
Now you're playing with us. Okay, good. These are your final 5. So these ones are questions, one word to 1 sentence answers. What have you been chasing in your life that you no longer pursue? So what had you previously chased in your life that you no longer pursue?
The need to be... Actually, I love playing shows. I always pursue that. I was going to say the need to be around lots of people.
Yeah.
I like thrive off my live shows. Yeah. I love it.
You can tell, man. When you watch the footage. Yeah, it's a good thing.
Okay, I'm going to say this. This is more personal, not emotional, but what have I been chasing in my life that I no longer pursue? The need to like crazy sports activities.
Right.
I just like, because as a kid, I would always like try to do, I still do the backflips, but in the snow, snowboarding or.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't need to jump the highest or farthest off a cliff. I can do 10, 12 meters. I'm happy. I don't need to go 15 or 18 meters, you know.
Mm. That's cool, man.
I still go pretty high though. I still do 12, 15 meters though.
But it doesn't have to be the highest. I get it.
It doesn't have to be the highest. Yeah. Because I'm going, I got to protect my brain and protect my spine.
Absolutely, man. Good answer. Okay, next one. If you could only leave 1 song of yours behind to be remembered by, which would it be?
one song to be remembered by, Pursuit of Happiness.
Okay.
My remix. It's not even my song. It's a remix I made, but it's such a classic song.
Yeah. Nice. I like it. Okay. Third question. What is one thing you believe 100% when it comes to making music that other people may disagree on? So what belief do you have about making music that you're so convinced about, but then if you share it or making art, but then other people are like, I'm not sure with you.
Could be one of two things. One is that my need to collaborate with the world.
Right.
Because there's a lot of purists that just obviously frown upon that.
Yes.
And I get a lot of flack on that.
Yes.
Whenever I work outside my genre, people are like, why are you doing that? Oh my God, it's horrible. If you go through my comments on Instagram, if I work with like a different artist, people just, there's a lot of people going, oh my God, what are you doing? Go back to this, you know? So
interesting.
Yeah. So I'll leave it with that one actually.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I like that one a lot because I get that sometimes for interviewing people that I find fascinating, but people would be surprised to see me next to it. And I've always
like me. People would be like, why the hell are you interview this guy? You should be interviewing a neuroscientist or something.
No, and we have plenty of you, but it's like, for me, I'm fascinated. Like I've always said that, you know, for me, I want to sit down opposite, like I'm only using this as an example, but it's like, I want to sit down opposite like Cardi B and talk about mindfulness and neuroscience of the mind. Like to me, I get excited by the fact that me and you are connecting on stuff that I don't think people from the outside would know.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, that's where I get my kind of bumps. I get you. Okay. Last two questions. If you could create a law that everyone in the world had to follow, what would it be?
Oh, wow. Wow. I'll try to answer this quickly, but this is definitely a good one to like sit and ponder on because if there's a law that like everyone must do, there's like a lot of things that everyone must do. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I'll probably be like, I should have said the other one, but let me come up with something quick. You know, it's the kind of thing about, you know, the first thing I think about is like, what do I want in the world? Yeah. Like, you know, you don't want, you want world peace. Those are like the most general topics. Like, you know, saving the world, saving ourselves, saving animals. So many things, like, you know, the gruesome torture of animals. I hate that. Oh my God.
So what would be the law? Kindness to all or?
Yeah. Yeah. Also the thing that kindness to all.
Yeah.
Be kind to everyone.
Okay.
Or else you're going to be put in jail for a long time.
Love the threat as well. Yeah. Awesome. Last question, Steve. What was your biggest lesson learned from the last 12 months of your life? What's the biggest lesson you've taken?
Well, okay. So coronavirus is probably what we're living in right now. So I'd say the lesson I've learned during this time is, you know, something that we can all, you know, that we should all, that we're probably all feeling right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, that's just being connected to our families.
Yeah. You know?
Especially people that are really busy in their lives. Now they can't do that. So
yeah,
I know. I just see it. I just hear from my friends. I see it from my friends, how they're like Zooming with their family members that they have never, that don't talk to at all.
Yeah. It's true.
So I need, I'm still reaching out to my family members, but like, I'm so glad that I'm close with my family and I'm so happy. I don't have to have any regret that I didn't, you know, and I just, that's like very, very important. Very important. More important than anything.
Awesome, man. That's incredible. Steve Aoki, everyone, make sure you go and listen to the album Neon Future 4. And as I mentioned before, his memoir, Blue, The Color of Noise. Steve, thank you so much for doing this, man. Thank you for being so generous with your time, so vulnerable and open with your answers. And this was a lot of fun, man. I love this. I really enjoyed it.
Cool,
and I hope we can connect in person when this is all over. But thanks again, man. I could have shared this with
you. All right.
Awesome. Thank you, man. Thanks, Steve.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth: no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.